Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Back in 1997, an unknown kid from Cambridge got together with his high school buddy to write and star in a movie about a wisecracking working-class genius from South Boston trying to find out what he wanted to do with his life. The kids? Matt Damon and Ben Affleck, of course. The film, Good Will Hunting, also starring one of their heroes, the late Robin Williams. That 1997 film scored screenwriter Oscars for Damon and Affleck and earned Williams his lone Oscar as Best Supporting Actor. Nearly 250 people joined us at the Coolidge Corner Theater last night to screen the film and talk about it in our latest live set in Boston. Our panel of critics included Allie Johnson of CambridgeDay.com and InBetweenDrafts.com, Tim Williams of Cape Cod Wave Magazine and Cape Cod Community College, and Bruno Guarana, a master lecturer at Boston University's Department of Film and Television. And we started the discussion with the audience, shouting out a few long-gone Boston features like The Tasty in Harvard Square and the Greyhound Races at Wonderland. That seemed like the perfect way to start then, by asking Tim if the film's more memorable because it starred two local kids instead of shooting for bigger named actors of the day as many studios had wanted.
I think it works because it seems so real. They seem so real in those roles, Affleck and Damon. Could somebody who isn't from Boston, who doesn't understand Boston, do the same thing? Maybe, but it's hard for me to imagine anybody else in those roles. So, you know, there's certain movies that are like that where these miracles happen. You know, it just seemed like the perfect combination.
Bruno, as you were watching it tonight, was this a film where the cast makes the difference?
I think so. I think Matt Damon, Ben Affleck are very well suited for the roles, and I would also shout out for Casey Affleck, does a wonderful job, right? The code switch that they do also with their accents, right? When they're within the Harvard bar, and Ben Affleck tries to tone down his accent to sound smarter. And you have Robin Williams not have the same accent that Matt Damon and Ben Affleck does. So all of these things are very subtle, but come across in regards to their class and their ethnicity, in an effort to fit in or to get the girl or to be buddy-buddy with their male friends and present their masculinity, that particular form of masculinity that you see in film.
So, Allie, you know, you and I have worked together on the show a number of times. I do sometimes save the girl question, right, for you, because so many of these iconic Boston films are such dude films, right? There's a kind of dark, toxic masculinity in them. And this is an interesting one where we have this one female character who has a big role to play to kind of hold her own. How does it play, do you think, today?
I mean, I think with context, it plays fine just because you know who wrote it. I think for the first half, she is so well written that it's almost upsetting by the second half, where they kind of do this bait and switch where she stops being her own individual character who has her own agency and it becomes about him. Minnie Driver is just so charming and charismatic in the role that I think it kind of overcomes a lot of the little flaws of her writing. And again, her and Matt Damon have a decent amount of chemistry that, again, you can kind of push aside the fact that, again, around the middle mark, around the part where he has his outburst and gets physical with her, she just stops being a character who actually has her own agency and is her own person. But he is our hero. You know, we're supposed to see him as protagonist, and we're also supposed to kind of forgive that moment. But it definitely depends on, you know, who is the actual hero, and are we supposed to be rooting for them?
Tim, as you were watching the film, was there a theme that stood out to you tonight that is different than what you've noticed in the past?
Yes.
What was it?
Letting go. And I was thinking about Ben Affleck's character. Matt Damon's his best bud. In some ways, he's the most important person in his life. And he's sort of sacrificing that friend in all of them. Even Minnie Driver's character, she's sort of not getting what she wants as far as Will going with her. But she has to move on, too. I mean, it's like, okay, well, I got to move on with my life. I'm not going to just crumble because you're not agreeing to be a part of what I want. And and Will has to let go of his history, and Robin Williams' character has to let go of, not let go of the memory of his wife, certainly, but to let go of the idea that his life is essentially over, and to realize there's more to be found.
Bruno, as you were watching the film tonight, did you find yourself thinking, you know what we should really be talking about is X?
I think I was stuck with looking at how the film sort of maps out these identities.
Interesting.
And so you have Matt Damon is the character who's possibly able to transition from away from South Boston, right, as Ben Affleck's character suggests, into the MIT Harvard world, right? So the T becomes that kind of link between these two areas, and noticeably to the Public Garden bench in which they sit, to have the conversation that sort of opens Will up. We have a very clear sense of the space of Sean's therapy office in the school, right? And so you have in one of the walls, you have a little banner with Ireland written on it. So that's when he's separate, right, from the other characters. And then on the opposite wall, you have his MIT diploma. So he's using sort of that, his knowledge and his experience to reach out to someone that he knows on a personal level and from sort of a personal experience rather than a professional experience. And then whenever they come together, both Will and Sean, as well as Sean and Gerald Limbo, you see that the windows where you have the painting that they talk about, and it's a little bit cheesy, I think, on the part of the film, but a tiny American flag. That, again, like the idea of the melting pot, that's where all these identities can come together, live in somewhat of harmony, but that harmony is also on the surface level only, because as you see, it breaks down.
All right, do we have a question? Are we ready with our first? Hi.
Hi, my name is Ken, and I love Coolidge Corner first. Thank
Yay.
You. Whoever, you know, built this building. The question was, is Whale Hunting, the Good Whale Hunting, actually not the name Whale Hunting, it's Wheel Hunting.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a journey, it's like a hunting journey to find your wheel. What do you really want?
Tim's nodding vigorously. I think you hit on something
I didn't
here.
Think of it until you mentioned it, thank you. That's one of the things that this movie's about, is like, you know, what do you want? And not what is everybody telling you to do, you know? Because otherwise, you just stumble through life. Like Ben Affleck's character says, I'm going to be 50 years old. It's going to be like tomorrow. And I'm going to be doing the same thing. Well, that's sort of stumbling through life. But what do you want? Well, go for it.
The other thing that Ken's question made me think of it, and we know this is there in the movie, right? We know, and yet it remained striking seeing it yet again. The choices that this movie makes and the ways that it chooses to deal with class, which is just in your face, right? We hear multiple times about tuition, right? Not just once, multiple times. Talk about class. Is it a good job? Is it a particularly good job? Is it a heavy-handed, cheap job at dealing with class? What do we think, Allie?
This, I mean, it's on the nose. For sure. And again, it is focusing on straight, cis, white men. So really, how far are they digging into classism in Boston? I think for the most part, because people call him out for it, and they're asking him, you could be doing the honorable job, like you're saying, but instead you're choosing to work at these prestigious schools to get your leg up, which people do, which makes sense. So again, I wouldn't say it's the most delicately handled film about class, but I think it could certainly have been a lot worse, yeah. Especially considering who was writing it, which was, again, two white guys from Boston.
I find it significant that the film discusses class at all. That's not very common, especially in the 90s in American films. But what I find troubling in this is that the film paints a picture of the only possibility to overcome his class background is through this amazing gift that he has, that's so unique. So that's how he can cross, that's how he can get the T to end up in an MIT office, right? Whereas if all he had was just whatever, like a normal person, an ordinary person, he wouldn't be able to get through the dorm room at Harvard, which he can't either, right? Mm-hmm. So at Harvard, he's a nobody because nobody knows of his gift. At MIT, he has access. So in some ways, the film is addressing class, but it gives a solution that's utterly unrealistic.
And judgmental of anybody who doesn't have that gift. Kyrie, do we have another audience member?
Speaking of things that have disappeared, what I was thinking, and I just wonder, is this movie why, like, being from Southie became cool? I mean, I know Southie was gentrified long before this movie came out, but I just was wondering, you know, did this, the success of this movie make, you know, Southie cool? Because, like, I remember, I, you know, knew kids who went to school on Saturdays when they were younger, so they wouldn't get the Boston accent, right? And now, having the Boston accent, a real one, is, like, really cool. Do you know
what
I mean?
Interesting. So I'm going to actually have you give the mic back to Kyrie. Kyrie, you did a little homework on the house in South Boston that Matt Damon's apartment was in. Is this correct?
Yes. So 190 West 6th Street, I believe, is the exact address of the place. And one of the apartments, actually the second floor apartment, he lived on the first floor. The second floor apartment is apparently for rent right now, and it's like $4,500. And I couldn't find out what the rent was back then, but I looked at the home prices, and it's the place itself, the three-decker, is worth estimated $750,000. Even just 10 years ago, it was half that.
So let me ask the three of you, sort of in the Boston zeitgeist, was there something about Good Will Hunting that affected the rep of South Boston, or do those things operate relatively independently? I mean, I am so used to thinking about the mob film movies being the thing that sort of pulls forward South Boston in the collective psyche. It's a question I hadn't thought of before. I don't know if any of the three of you have a thought.
I did watch it going, you know, man, I miss it when people cared about set design. You know, like all the apartments feel so lived in, and I don't know if that makes it cool to want to live there or not, but to me as a film viewer, I'm so used to seeing things these days where it just looks like it's straight out of a Pottery Barn catalog. Like, right. Nothing has been touched, you know? Whereas if you look at something like this, it does feel kind of authentic, which is kind of a gross word to use when you're talking about film, but it does. And I don't know, again, maybe it did make it more popular, but I think now, I wonder if it would almost make it more so, because again, you just are watching a place that clearly has been loved, clearly has been lived in. Friends are comfortable living in there. And I just think, so that was mainly my takeaway in terms of location, but I would be curious now to go back and look it up and see if maybe there was like a rise in renters.
Mm. So I think we've got time for two more questions. I will take one more audience question, and then I have one more. Kyrie's got me somebody over here.
Thank you so much. You spoke a bit about the production of the film at the beginning, and I was wondering if we could talk about the Harvey Weinstein of it all. I mean, before the film even begins, you see the Miramax logo. And so I was just wondering for you all, does his involvement with the film and making it very prestigious and awards-worthy affect your experience watching it? Do you think it affects its legacy? I'd love to hear your thoughts.
When I saw Miramax, and when I saw Bob Weinstein, Harvey Weinstein among the producers, I cringed, but that's it. It's not going to affect how I view what's on the screen based on the fact that he was involved in the movie.
I do agree largely with the idea of separating the art from the artist. And luckily, Harvey Weinstein wasn't an artist. He was a man with a lot of money. So the actual direction of the film doesn't feel like it was altered by him. But usually I am, you kind of have your own barometer. Like, I don't watch Woody Allen movies these days, sorry. You know, it's kind of hard to separate the art from the artist when he's literally in the film dating 17-year-olds. But for me, in this case, it's just one of those, he's the worst. Glad he's where he is. I'm going to watch this movie because Robin Williams is amazing.
But I think it's important to name it. And I think I'm glad that you raised it. When we have these conversations, context matters. And us naming it matters. Which means our loss of Robin Williams is an important piece of the context to matter, to name. And I'm going to take a moment, because he died by suicide, to remind everybody here that if you or someone that you love or care about is experiencing a mental health crisis or is experiencing suicidal thoughts, there's a 24/7 hotline that's available to you by text or phone. The number is 988. It was something to watch him do a film about mental health, knowing how we lost him in the end. And I feel like we can't finish, especially given how remarkable his presence in that film is. And he improvised, once again, a good chunk of the lines in his scenes. That son of a blank, he stole my line, totally made up, improvised in the moment. The scene where he tells that awful story about his wife asleep, completely made up. That's why Matt Damon was laughing so hard, because he could not believe what Robin Williams was saying, because he was making it up. And what I'm going to do is ask each of you to honor one thing about his performances that you have loved over the years, and we'll close with that. So, Allie.
I think it's his empathy. I think he clearly was a giving scene partner, and it just exuded from him. So, yeah, that's the one of many.
Yeah. Bruno.
I was going to say something similar when Tim talked about the film being about letting go. What I was thinking was the film is about empathy. Robin Williams is the one who teaches Will, or Matt Damon, and us about empathy through the stories about his wife, which are very touching. And in the very sort of moving scene in which he keeps repeating, it's not your fault, which I think is a really important line, an important mantra. When one is dealing with mental health issues. I think we all need to hear that every once in a while.
Tim?
You know, there was such a depth to his performances. And I mean, sometimes he'd be playing pretty hideous characters, but he would dig deep, and he sure did in this movie. I mean, every scene he's in, you almost want to just break out crying. I mean, there's so much emotion. It's so genuine. And so I think he just, horrors he was experiencing personally, he somehow was able to, it was such a gift, you know, to be able to present that kind of humanity. It's like a privileged moment to see him on the screen when he's at his best like that.
Tim Miller, adjunct film professor at Cape Cod Community College, Allie Johnson, editor-in-chief at InBetweenDrafts.com, and Bruno Guarana, master lecturer at BU. And let's go out with the final song from the film, Miss Misery, by Elliott Smith.
And I try to be, but you know me, I.